But underlying my talk tonight will be the message that we can no longer remain apathetic in the face of discrimination and injustice. It is correct, I represent Omar Khadr, who has been detained in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, since the age of 15, and he's presently 24 years of age. But I'm also a lawyer, and it is in that capacity tonight that I want to speak to each and every one of you. Because as a lawyer, I believe in law, and I believe in justice. And like most Canadians, I care deeply about human rights. And it's a word that I'm sort of moving away from, because the phrase I like even better is human dignity. And I understand that with the current events since 9/11, it is easy to feel that international law, everyday justice, and human rights have been abandoned. And as time passes, my deepest fears have become increasingly confirmed. I have come to see international human rights law as having a dysfunctional relationship with justice. The rhetoric is certainly beautiful, but it's all dressed up with nowhere to go. In the wake of the 9/11 attacks in the United States, many countries have adopted an increasing array of counter-terrorism measures which do not comply with their obligations under international law or under international human rights law or even under refugee law or humanitarian law. Those laws have all been deliberately avoided or simply ignored in the war on terror. Instead, many countries are violating human rights simply in the name of counterterrorism. And we are, in this day and age, witnesses to disturbing events with habeas corpus all but abandoned south of the border, secret courts being created to hear secret evidence, guilt being inferred by association, and torture and rendition nakedly being justified. And I say to you, it is difficult to exaggerate the risk to society as a whole when governments depart from their obligation to uphold the rule of law. And I'm not simply talking about the American government, I'm talking about our own government. Now, I want to be a bit academic here. I do accept, and it is an accepted fact today, that grave challenges face the world, challenges to the rule of law and human rights. Previously well-established and accepted legal principles are now being called into question in all regions of the world through what I would suggest are ill-conceived responses to terrorism. Many of the achievements in the legal protection of human rights are under attack. And terrorism certainly poses a serious threat today. And one, just as criminal activity poses a threat. And one would be foolish not to recognize that all governments have an obligation to take effective measures to protect its citizens against any acts of terrorism. In fact, under international law, all governments both have a right and a duty to protect its citizens. But it's not simply a utilitarian calculation of balancing the right of security of the many against the legal rights of the few. Because to do so would simply be to ignore those values on which our democratic society has been built. Because when in the so-called, and I say so-called, war on terror, because I believe it's overstated, we are fighting for more than the safety of our citizens. And though that's an important thing to do, we are also fighting for the preservation of our democratic way of life, our right to freedom of thought and expression, and our commitment to the rule of law. Those liberties which have been hard won over centuries and which each and every one of us hold dear. And those rights encompass things such as the right to life, the prohibition against torture, the presumption of innocence, the right to a fair trial by an independent and impartial tribunal, and so on. And in our commitment to the rule of law, we must never compromise on long-standing principles of justice and liberty. So, defeating terrorism means convincing the world of the importance of following the rule of law. The rule of law is at the heart of our democratic systems. And those that are suspected of being terrorists are not outside the law, nor do they forfeit their fundamental rights by virtue of that fact. And I say to you that we will become, and we have become, severely handicapped in countering terrorism's violation of human life when our own conduct expresses the same disrespect for human life as those that we criticize. And we cannot expect people to live up to values we ourselves don't even follow. And when I talk about the rule of law, you know, I'm not talking about laws which impose apartheid or segregation or lock away people in such bad places as Guantanamo Bay without due processes. These are bad laws, and these laws are a restraint upon liberty and justice. I'm talking about laws that promote justice and exercise restraint on the misuse of power. 10 years have passed since 9/11, when Muslims in the United States were rounded up in their thousands and incarcerated without access to lawyers or their loved ones. And since then, Muslims have been made to pay a terrible price for the actions of 19 fanatics who in no way represented Islam or its values. Afghanistan and Iraq were bombed and invaded as a direct consequence of 9/11. Thank you. Over a million men and women and children have been killed in those countries. Untold numbers maimed, widowed, and orphaned. Innocent Muslims have been humiliated and tortured in places such as Bagram, Abu Ghraib, and Guantanamo. And some of those, as you heard from Moza, were abducted from their homes or off the streets of Europe, and then hooded and spirited away to a secret black prison, either in Europe or Guantanamo or elsewhere. So can we now, 10 years later, state with satisfaction that we have become a stronger, a more tolerant and compassionate society since 9/11? Are we safer? The reality is that public anxiety has simply increased along with intolerance, discrimination, and bigotry. The phrase "the war on terror" has simply become synonymous with Islam and Muslims. in the minds of many. In the everyday media, we're used to hearing, continually hearing such words as threats, evil, Islam, Muslim, all in the context of terrorism. And this results in the form of a moral panic resonating in the everyday psyche of people, with the implication that, that action must be taken to defeat the enemy, those Muslims. And as a result, it is easy for people to accept that drastic measures must be taken in the interests of security, even if it means the suspension of civil liberties, compromising our values, ignoring the rule of law. Because, we rationalize it's for our own good. What we are witnessing is the constant drip of sanity slipping from our grasp as our apathy has allowed whispers of anti-Muslim sentiment to become part of the mainstream of conversation. I was in San Francisco a couple of years ago, and I spoke to the University of San Francisco, and I talked to a whole bunch of judges, a whole bunch of lawyers, and a whole ton of students. And I arrived there pretty tired, and I started off by addressing this so-called prestigious audience by saying, "Well, we know all Muslims are terrorists." The audience doesn't say much. And I said, if they're not terrorists, they know someone who is a terrorist. And by then, things people were getting a little bit uneasy. And then I said, but it doesn't matter because they're all going to become terrorists. And you could feel the tension. I think they're getting ready to throw me out of the room. And then I went on about, look, let's not kid ourselves. I'm happy when I go into an airport and I'm a white Anglo-Saxon Scot as opposed to a Muslim. I get to go through the airport relatively unscathed. So we understand well that we associate Muslims with terrorism. And we cannot tackle manifestations of intolerance unless we understand how that constant use of fear that Scott talked about pervades our everyday life, and how that fear begins to influence how we think and how we act. It is that same manipulation of fear which allowed military escapades into countries beyond those who bombed the Twin Towers. And it's that same message that has been exploited by participating governments to reduce civil liberties and infringe upon human rights by allowing places such as Guantanamo Bay to exist. And amongst those is our own Canadian government and the Canadian people. Now I admit, I am baffled and I'm disappointed by the lack of reaction of Muslims and Arabs leaders to the continuous physical and verbal attacks on Islamic peoples everywhere. But I'm also outraged, and I am outraged, by the disregard of many public institutions and leaders, from bureaucrats to politicians and others, for failing to speak out against a shared sense of injustice. This is what our politicians were created to do, and this is what they're paid for, to ensure that we all live in a civil society, respectful of everyone. And this present state of affairs was not always this way. Up and until the beginning of the Second World War, Canada's approach to civil rights, human rights, was focused on the individual. And it was not until after 1945, after the Second World War, Canada and Canadians came to the realization that protecting individuals solely had come at the price of ignoring the rights of groups. The rights of groups to retain their identities without fear of the loss of life, the loss of liberty, or even the pursuit of happiness. It was the horrifying spectacle of group destruction in the Second World War which jolted us. Teachers, trade unionists, Jews, gypsies, you name it, and so on. A spectacle of horror, so far removed from what we thought were the limits of violations in civilized societies. We came then to recognize that individuals could be denied rights, not in spite of, but because of their differences. And so we started to formulate ways to protect the rights of groups in addition to the rights of individuals. In other words, we had come to see the brutal role of discrimination, and so we invented the term human rights to confront it. The global community then constructed legal systems and institutions to enhance and advance international human rights law. And through the UN Charter, we made a commitment, we, Canada, America, Europe, and so on, made a commitment to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and the worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women, and of nations, large and small. Civil liberties had given us the universal right to be equally free from an intrusive state, regardless of group identity, whether Palestinian or Jew, Christian or Muslim, black or white. Human rights had given us the universal to be equally free from group discrimination based on group identity. But this human rights revolution, which started after the Second World War, I say to you, is under siege. We are in a generation that has the most sophisticated development of international law, treaties and conventions the international community has ever known, all stating the same thing, that human rights abuses will not be tolerated. And yet, the international community cannot agree on international law generally, so sovereignty and human rights continues to conflict. So what is going on? What do we need to do to fix it? And fix it, I say to you, we must. Because unless we pay attention to intolerance and discrimination, we risk the continued breakdown of the rule of law, without which we can very easily descend into lawlessness and chaos. And when I say descend, I'm sure Mubin Mozam would disagree with me. We are at that stage. That's why we have Guantanamo Bay. That's why we have Abu Ghraib. We are in a state of lawlessness. There are no rules anymore. We have so many laws to protect humanity from injustice, yet I say to you that we lack the will to turn those laws into justice. And that's the responsibility not only I and others share. It's not for me just to go to court and fight year after year. It's a conversation that you all share in. You have a responsibility to each other to ensure that human rights and human dignity is taking place. And yet, we choose to remain silent. We remain indifferent. We remain complacent because, you know, we don't wish to be seen as standing out. We rationalize, you know, it's not our problem. Keep quiet. You know, that's for others to take care of. And it's not just you here I'm talking. The Law Societies of Canada invited me to come to Vancouver a few years ago, and they wanted to give me an award. They gave me a little glass thing. And the last thing I wanted was a little glass thing. So I said I wasn't going. And then we had negotiations. And I said, I'll come so long as I can speak about Omar Khayyam. And so I spoke to over 200 lawyers for an hour about Guantanamo Bay, Islamophobia, Omar Khayyam. And I received a standing ovation. But I received not one call or one email after that. And that has been my experience for the past 8 years. There's not a place that I haven't spoken to. I've been in Ivy League University south of the border, and I've been every place in Canada. You won't get me stopping talking about Guantanamo Bay. But my email box doesn't fill up for people offering to help. And I say this to you because I want to also be positive, which is not easy being a Scot. The world is out there. It is waiting for change. It won't wait for you. Grab it and make it happen. And if you stood up to the challenges, if you stood up to challenge insidious values which do not reflect your own, you would find that you're not standing alone either. You would discover that there are legal institutions and there are individuals fighting to protect all those values each and every one of us here cherish. One has only to look at the recent decision I and my co-counsel obtained both in the Canadian Supreme Court last year and the Ontario Court of Appeal just recently. In 2010, in the case of Canada and the Prime Minister versus Omar Khayyam, the Supreme Court of Canada dealt with a case involving agents from Canadian intelligence services questioning Omar in Guantanamo Bay and sharing the results of those interviews with the United States, knowing that Omar had been subject to sleep deprivation for weeks to make him less resistant to the interrogations of him. He was 16 then, and they came back when he was 17. Our court, our Canadian Supreme Court rule, went on to rule that the United States had violated the International Convention on Torture and the Geneva Conventions, and that Canada was complicit in that misconduct. Think of that accusation. Not just our government, but we Canadians were accused of being complicit in torture. Where was the resounding cries in the streets about our reputation being sold so cheaply? But compare that approach with the ruling in August 2010, where the Guantanamo military judge, in Omar's case, ruled that all of Omar Khayyam's confessions were admissible, and they could be used as evidence, no matter how they were obtained. We had provided witnesses, soldiers who witnessed the abuse of Omar Khayyam, and yet the military judge allowed that evidence in. And very recently, in an extradition case involving Abdullah Khayyam, Omar's older brother, a Superior Court of Justice, Christopher Speier, refused to extradite Abdullah to the United States to face terrorism charges. Speier wrote in a 62-page ruling that human rights violations suffered by Khayyam were both shocking and unjustifiable, that the evidence being relied upon by the United States were confessional statements obtained solely from the torture and abuse of Abdullah while held in a basement of a secret prison in Islamabad, Pakistan, for over 14 months. The issues in Abdullah Khayyam's case underscored the great legal debate about the limits on interrogations, cooperation with countries with poor human rights records, and the tension between intelligence collection and criminal prosecution. And these concerns were later addressed by the Interior Court of Appeal in upholding the decision to stay the extradition proceedings. A unanimous court stated that to allow the United States extradition request would damage the integrity and the reputation of the Canadian courts. It would amount to being complacent with torture. The court also went on to say we must adhere to our democratic and Canadian legal values, and that intelligence collecting can never trump the rule of law and human rights. Now, compare that ruling to the recent ruling of the United States Court of Appeal in the Ninth Circuit, which legalized, very recently, the CIA abduction and torture of innocent American citizens. It ruled that innocent civilians tortured and detained, even after release, have no rights of recourse against the CIA or corporations such as Blackwater, because such litigation would jeopardize state secrets and top secret classified information critical to national security. You've heard that language time and time again. So we're witnesses, this is my hopeful comment, we're witnesses to two very different approaches to human rights when competing with the issues of national security. Canadian courts, when you get there, see themselves as the guardians of our liberties, protected under our Constitution, while the United States' fixation on security has led to limitations on civil liberties and laws. These Canadian court decisions involve major commitment over many years by such as myself at great personal expense. However, these legal examples demonstrate how changes can be made for the better, and more changes, with the support of each and every one of you here. But this has not happened. The power, and that's what I want to emphasize, you have the power. You have the power to make change. Just don't be scared. The power of the individual to strive for freedom and justice, you know, you can't underestimate it. I tell kids, I'm a powerful guy. Tell my kids that, they laugh, my own kids. You know, I take on governments and I've been successful. And they haven't locked me away. So I wish to conclude the rest of my talk by giving you two further examples of what I believe are individual efforts to fight for human dignity despite overwhelming odds. One of the stories is the hunger strikers at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Firstly, in my view, Guantanamo Bay is a necessary propaganda tool for the war on terror. It's a place where we are told terrorists are held. Mind you, any American who is charged with terrorism, my goodness, he doesn't go to Guantanamo Bay. He gets the full process of due process on the American mainland. But anyway, we all know this is where the worst of the worst are detained, including Omar Khadr. And people of Islamic faiths from all over the world have been arbitrarily detained there for many years under incessant, inhuman conditions, without being charged with any offense, with no opportunity to see the evidence or the opportunity of having a trial. Mohsen begs, tells you, in front of my children, in front of his children, in front of his wife. He's chained, he's strapped, he's hooded, and he disappears. We have allowed Guantanamo Bay to exist. We have allowed those excesses of abuses to exist. And as long as we don't stand up, they will continue. Things have not got better 10 years on, they're just getting worse. And those detainees, they're not allowed to be seen or heard. They're not permitted access to the media. They're not permitted visits from human rights organizations, reporters, any consular visits, or visits by family and friends. And that's 10 years on. And that's why I started off. I said Guantanamo is a propaganda coup because it's left in your mind to consider the evil that lies in Guantanamo Bay. Because if you ever to meet these individuals, you may very well change your mind. You saw one of those terrible terrorists just recently, an hour ago, Mozambique's. And what is he doing? He's doing terrible things now. He's running a human rights organization. And of course we don't want people like him in the States because we want to protect ourselves from that terrorist. No, we want to protect ourselves from the voice of people like Mozambique's. And we're told that because of Guantanamo, we're all now safer and can all sleep better. And we're just simply to accept that the government knows what's best for us and should be left to get on with the job. That's the same language we use here in Canada. It's the same language I meet every day when I fight my way up to get disclosure. I'm not entitled to that disclosure because I and the Canadian public, you know, we just can't be trusted with no secret information. So I have to go to a secret court and fight in a secret court. And then what do I find? I find the information isn't that secret after all. It covers up egregious misconduct by our government. That's what I found out after 5 years. 5 years of fighting with the government all the way up to the Supreme Court in Cairo's first Supreme Court case. In Omar's first Supreme Court case. All I was after was disclosure. Some documents. And when I got those documents, what did I find? I was fine, first of all, Omar was entitled to them because he got them. But the second thing I found was, after all those years of fighting, the reason we were not provided those documents hid the fact of Canada's involvement in Guantanamo Bay.
Shame.
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 And though we've all been told by human rights organizations, particularly at the outset, such as Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and other human rights organizations, they've all publicly alleged that many of the detainees were simply innocent taxi drivers and farmers sold to the Americans for money by the Northern Alliance. In fact, a 2006 Pentagon document indicated, and this is their own documents, that the military had determined that only 45% of the detainees had committed some form of hostile act against the United States. And that only 8% of those were Al-Qaeda fighters. So no description of what constituted a hostile act or how it was determined what constituted a hostile act was ever stated. But what about the rest, the other 52% that they said presented no threat to the United States? Who cares? They stay there. They don't care. No one demanded them back. They just continued to live in that hellhole called Guantanamo Bay. And we'll never know the truth about that 48%. Because you'll never see those detainees or hear them. Because they're simply hidden behind a curtain of silence. Now, many of those detainees have now been quietly released, such as Mozart, after years of detention, without being charged with any offence or given any explanation, and returned to their homeland or other countries. So I say to you today that today, no one can credibly maintain that the prisoners in Guantanamo Bay are the worst of the worst 10 years after the first plane load of prisoners have come and gone. A ready stream of interrogators, translators, analysts attest exactly to the opposite. And hundreds of prisoners, as I said to you, have been released with no explanation as to why they were kept. And they've been released secretly because it would damage the fiction. You don't release the worst of the worst. You don't release the most evil of terrorists, the virus that's going to contaminate North America. So if we publicly announce the release of these detainees, then there'd be some explaining to do. We don't explain, we do it secretly, and we continue the fiction. And nobody in Guantanamo Bay, in my view, whether he's wearing an Al-Qaeda logo on his back, is guilty of anything until he gets a trial. Until you get a trial, you're innocent. And that's not Dennis Edney saying that. That has been a tradition in law for centuries. But it's not a tradition in Guantanamo Bay, and it's not a tradition that our country, that our government demands be upheld. You know, even former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, as you well know, a loving man, a fine friend of George Bush and his policies, described Guantanamo as an anomaly. He said that at some point has to be brought to an end. Well, thank you, Tony. But I say to you that Guantanamo, in its existence, provides powerful evidence, stark evidence, of how America and the West make war on terror synonymous with the war against Islam. And so I told you that I wanted to talk about the hunger strikers. So while those tragic human beings, these hunger strikers, these detainees, are shut away, they long for their voices to be heard or someone to speak out on their behalf. I recall going to see Omar one time, and I was walking down some pathway. What I should tell you before I go there, Omar doesn't live in cages. Omar and others live in three secret prisons in Guantanamo Bay, Camp 5, Camp 6, Camp 7. They are concrete buildings in the desert. They're windowless, surrounded by rows and rows of barbed wire. They're ominous and they're silent. And I've been in Camp 5 and Camp 6 many times. I'll be there in July. And as the Pentagon say, Camp 5 and Camp 6 and Camp 7 are designed for enhanced interrogation techniques. Torture. That's where Omar Khadr is tonight. He's sitting in some salted cell in Camp 5. But there's Camp 7. And you are not allowed, when you're in Guantanamo Bay, to mention Camp 7 or ask any questions. Because the prisoners in Camp 7, they're just nobody. They were brought over last year from some of the prisons in Europe and other countries. And I remember saying to a lieutenant colonel, who was the head of all the lawyers, the military lawyers for the Western Seaboard, the Eastern Seaboard, I said, how do we get lawyers to these guys in Camp 7? And he said, forget it, Mr. Edney. They're toast. And all the rest of these well-educated, Harvard-educated lawyers all nodded their head in approval. So one can only imagine what goes on in Camp 7. So one of the few ways of expressing themselves, one of the very few ways of protesting, is for detainees to go on a hunger strike in a hope of bringing attention to their plight. Hundreds of detainees at Guantanamo Bay are known to have engaged in hunger strike protests since 2002. But it wasn't that long ago, it was only last year actually, that I was approached by a former Brigadier General in Guantanamo Bay who asked me if I had been to Camp 5. And he was sent by Obama to Guantanamo Bay at the very early days to see if he could make the conditions in Guantanamo less severe. And so I went with him to Camp 5, and I went to him to this Unit C that he asked me if I'd been in. And I said, I've been in Camp 5, but I've never been to Unit C. So I go to UNICE. And what you have to understand is that UNICE is 32 single cells. And each one of those detainees who had been chosen to be a hunger striker was moved into these solitary cells. And that was over 5 years ago. And no one ever asked these detainees, as rotations changed, as military personnel moved on, knocked on the door of these cells and said to any one of those detainees, "Do you still wish to be a hunger striker?" Assuming they ever were in the first place. No one asked that question. And the review of the documents, there was nothing to determine what criteria was being used to determine where someone was a hunger striker or where he was simply on a fast. But outside of each cell is a restraining chair, or what I call a feeding chair. So those individuals are now into their 6th year in Guantanamo in these solitary cells because we're deemed to be in a hunger strike. But the story gets better. Because outside each cell is a feeding chair for each cell, and 3 times a day they are force-fed, they're strapped into those chairs by the feet, by the waist, by the neck, put into these chairs with tubes inserted down their nose, and they're force-fed 3 times a day. And then after that, they're left sitting in the chair for hours. And amongst those is my friend Mohammed Babazir. I may be mutilating his name. And Mohammed is a Yemeni prisoner. And he had been subject to this treatment. And it was him that the Brigadier General wanted me to meet. And what happened with Mohammed is that his lawyers made an application to the federal court based upon information that I provided, this Brigadier General provided, after speaking to Mohammed, and we set up a federal court application for him. And we were able to get through his psychiatrist, or a psychiatrist, his medical records. Let me tell you, that didn't take overnight, that took months. And we showed that Mohammed was fed by a special tube, an extra large tube, that went through his nose. And that Mohammed gave evidence in an affidavit that he was left strapped in a restraining chair until he urinated and defecated on himself. So it shows you how long he was left in a chair. And this was deliberately inflicted on him just for simply for gratuitous pain and humiliation. And the Justice Department's response before Judge Kessler in the federal court is quite telling, and actually be humorous if it weren't for the seriousness of the situation. They said to the judge that the feeding process had been designed for the prisoner's comfort and protection. But even if the allegations made by Mr. Redney and the other lawyers are true, the prisoner had no right to bring his complaint to the court. And the judge upheld them. The judge said it's an in-house training, it's in-house, it's correctional services duty, the courts can't touch that. And Mohammed's psychiatrist, Emily Kern from California, lovely lady, she told me that the tubes had done permanent damage to his nose and throat, so we wrote that into the affidavit. The reality is, 5 and 6 years on, tubes do more than just damage to your nose and throats. Mohammed was down to 100 pounds and less. And I also recall what Mohammed said about his hunger strike. He said, "I'm a human being who has been treated like an animal, and I'm fighting from my dignity. So I say to you, this is an individual who has struggled in a most horrific, repressive system to preserve his humanity at all costs, the courage. And I could tell you other stories been going all night of the human courage of people trying to maintain their dignity. And so I gave you that particular example because it's his struggle and the struggle of others is not worthy of our concern. And this is not the first time I've spoken about the hunger strikers in places. And so, thank you for your patience. My final story is that of Omar Khadr. His story and his life in Guantanamo Bay reflects the failure of civil society, which is us, its institutions, which is our churches, whether it's Christian, Jewish, Muslim, they're all, in my view, log thrown in together. And its people, all of us, to speak out in ensuring our shared values, because we're decent people. We try to live decent lives. We try to bring our kids up well. So we want, it's a failure of us to speak out in ensuring our shared values of a just society are carried out. You know, it was in January of 2002 we first saw the shocking images of human beings in rows in aircraft, hooded and shackled for transportation across the Atlantic, much as other human beings had been carried in slave ships 400 years earlier. We witnessed the captors humiliating these anonymous human beings unloaded at Guantanamo Bay, crouched in open cages in orange jumpsuits, all deliberately displayed for the world to see. Many of you saw that on TV. And amongst them, when you think back to when you saw that on TV, amongst them was a young boy, a young Canadian boy, Omar Khadr. And I say to you, for each and every one of you, for the watching world, we saw those images on television, no knowledge of international humanitarian law was needed to be understood. You knew intuitively that what you were witnessing was unlawful. This was not a manifestation of the Geneva Conventions at work, nor was it an act of deportation or an act of extradition. It was far worse. It was the unlawful transportation to a world outside the reach of the law, and it was intended to remain so. In that world, crimes against inhumanity were to be carried out in Guantanamo Bay under a conspiracy or a curtain of silence. Now, Guantanamo has been called everything from an offshore concentration camp to a legal black hole. It has become a symbol of much that is wrong with our society. It is a complex of brutal prisons where hundreds of men and children from all over the world have been held there under incredibly inhuman conditions and incessant interrogations. I can tell you, I'm inhuman. I went to Guantanamo Bay as a lawyer who had lots of experience in doing some pretty big trials, and I've represented some people that you wouldn't like to bring home. So I thought I was a tough constitutional criminal lawyer. But when I went to Guantanamo Bay and I came out of there, I changed forever. I'm driven. I think when I sit with my kids and we're having a nice dinner and my wife has prepared something nice, I remind my kids what takes place while we're eating. And I could tell you what goes on in Guantanamo this very night. I can't avoid it. It's a place without rules. And it's a place where a Canadian, Omar Khadr, has spent a quarter of his life. He was 15 when he went there. We have a 14-year-old boy here. So Omar was a year older. And I think of that because I have a 15-year-old boy. and 15-year-old boys on a different mental level than you and I. My wife called me during the winter to speak to Duncan, my 15-year-old. He'd used a snowblower to pile up tons of snow in the backyard, and then he was on the roof going to use a snowblower and ski off the roof into this huge pile, assuming he'd hit the pile. That's 15-year-old boys. And that's a place where Omar Khayyam has been arbitrarily detained. And I say arbitrarily detained because it's only recently that he got a trial. It wasn't that long ago he was charged. He spent years there, years in solitary confinement, years in abuse. It's a pity Mozan wasn't here, because he could tell you even more stories. He could tell you stories of witnessing, as Omar can, Muslims being killed in front of them. I cross-examined torturers in Guantanamo Bay. Yeah. So, I first met Omar when I first went to Guantanamo. I recall being on the plane and I was thinking, this is great. My ego was running riot. I'd made it in. The first guy, first lawyer, got a client in Guantanamo. And I'm thinking, get off the plane. And then I walked in to see Omar. And Omar was in Camp 6 at the time. And he was sitting in a cold, windowless cell, shackled from the waist to the concrete floor, and handcuffed. And I always, when I saw him like that, and I've always thought like this, in a bizarre kind of way, I thought, they must think he's Superman, because you know how if you see a Superman movie, Superman can shoot through the ceilings and away he goes. Well, here's Omar in a windowless cell, sitting on a stool. And that's particularly interesting because he's got problems with arthritis in his knees. And so when you sit on a stool, you have to bend your knees. Anything that makes you uncomfortable, Guantanamo Bay will come up with it. And by then, when I saw him, he had been in solitary confinement for over 2 years, enduring crushing loneliness and abandonment by the world. And he looked pale, he looked ill, he was shivering. Because shivering is another technique in Guantanamo Bay. We keep the place freezing. He was uncomfortable with his body and he ached all over. In fact, I was startled. I remember just gasping as I walked into this cell. Because to me, he reminded me of a broken little bird. And so I spent time with Omar. It took a while, because Omar hadn't spoken for months to anybody. And as I got up to leave, he said to me, "You will leave me. Everyone does." And I recall saying to him, "No, I won't. I'll always be there." And I can't say that's when I say that, I want you to understand that was never an easy commitment. Because I don't want you to feel sorry for me, but I can tell you there have been two or three times in my life, in my years with Omar, when I've walked the floor mentally drafting a goodbye letter. Why should I go to Guantanamo? Why should I leave my kids? Why should my wife worry about the credit cards being... I had a great law practice. You know, someone else will take care of it, really, and get on with life. And I wanted to say that many times to Omar, and I haven't. I made a promise, but I find it hard to keep. And since then, he and I have grown up together. When I will see Omar on July the 3rd, he will be in a cell and he will be sitting on a chair. Things have improved, become far more humanitarian in Guantanamo. He gets a chair. And he is always, always chained from the waist to the floor. I have never seen him walk, other than the few occasions that we've been in court. All those years, I've never seen him walk. And I have one of those other chairs, and I sit next to him, and he and I put head to head. And we talk. And when he's troubled, we whisper. And why do we do that? Because we have a camera watching us, we're being audio taped, and we could have anything from 12 soldiers sitting around to at least two. And I am not, because I'm so distrustworthy and such a terrorist lover, that I can't even go to the toilet without being accompanied. And so we have engaged in private conversations over the years, and I've watched him grow from a small boy to a big, growing man. And we share stories about ourselves, and I tease him. Because I'm his voice to the outside world, I'm his messenger, I'm his postman. And I come there and I tell him stories. Sometimes I make them up. I tell him real true stories that his sister Zainab bullies me. And he loves hearing that. He just loves it, you know, like I'm getting pushed around by Zainab. And I share other things with him. And when I look across at him, particularly over the last year or so, I see someone. I look at this young man that I've grown up with. He's my son, and I've never heard him complain, just as Mozam says. And I see someone who's experienced so much pain and deprivation. You know, I spoke with the soldier that he told me that when he was lying on the bed in hospital, in the Bagram hospital, this soldier thought it funny to drop his pants and stick his bum in his face time and time again and flatulate him, making a vulgar sound. While nurses and doctors, humiliation. I've spoken with the leader, Sergeant Claus, a killer of Muslims, who interrogated Omar Khadr 48 times in that hospital, that bloody hospital. That hospital that Omar said was nothing but a torture chamber. All you could hear was the cries of those who were injured with pain and those who were being tortured. That resonated with me. So when I look at him and I see someone who has experienced so much pain, and when I look at his body that has suffered such injuries, and I see him as the possibility of going blind, totally blind, very real possibility. And so, and let me address that. You all clapped, and I've told you about my legal experience. Well, you know, I'm the last guy you should ever hire. Because I have spent close to 8 years trying to get him a protective pair of glasses just for his remaining good eye. And it was only in November of last year that he finally, 7 years later, was given protective eyeglasses. And I have written letters to the Department of Foreign Affairs, to the government, and that's the extent of the help he's received from the government. Can't even give him a pair of glasses. And then I think of the abuses that he has suffered from authority figures. I told you, I saw Claus, a killer. Claus killed one detainee and crippled two others using the same interrogation techniques on Omar. And he went, and he, because his group were just so bad, they went from, conversely, they were also so good at what they did, that they went from Abu Ghraib to Guantanamo, and they went from Guantanamo to Abu Ghraib. They were so successful. But because they were so bad, Claus was then charged with the killing and maiming of two detainees. And he got a 6-month sentence for that. 6 months. And I saw Claus before the trial strutting around Guantanamo Bay and being hailed like a hero. So I try, when I look at Oman, I try to hide my own deep despair and my deep sadness, because I spend so much of my time telling Omar stories of what we're going to do when he comes out. We'll go to my lake, we'll fish, there's hardly anybody there, we'll canoe, and we'll travel into the mountains. And he knows the geography of Western Canada because I've taken him there. And then I think, I have never met anyone like Omar, whom I believe who can give so much to the world and yet has been so abandoned by so many who should know better. And all the times I've been with him, I've never heard him say an angry word about anyone. Well, it was his jailers who had him hanging, as described by Mosin Beggs, or whether it was his jailers who used his head while he strung up by the arms, and if he urinated on himself, his head was used as a mop to clean up the urine. He's never showed any anger. He doesn't have an inch of anger in him. What he is, he's a good man. He's a devout Muslim. He has great faith. And that's why I've always been sort of more touched with the Muslim community. Because when I've seen these Muslims in Guantanamo Bay who have suffered so much, it is their faith that has helped them. And so I've asked him, in preparing him for his release, what does he want to do when he gets out? What he dearly wants to do? He wants to get educated. What else does he want to do? He wants to be a doctor. Not a lawyer, thank you, but a doctor. And why? Because he wants to help all those who have suffered. And Mozam touched upon that. I don't understand it, but the reality is that there are those in Guantanamo Bay, such as Omar, such as Mozam, who have no reason to feel any kindness towards anybody, and yet have become far more human, far more compassionate. Probably found something somewhere in here where they realize that the humanity has such goodness that can't be wasted on hate. And so until his release, he will continue as he's doing tonight, sit in a solitary windowless cell, waiting for my next visit and any news I will bring him. So I wish to conclude on these final comments. When we cave in to fear and apathy, when we fear to speak out in opposition, there are no longer boundaries to state action and impermissible behavior. And if we, and I talk about each and every one of us, if we walk away from our duty to uphold human values, who is going to speak for us when our turn comes? So as I started, I'll finish. Embedded in my talk today has been the responsibility, the imperative to stand against injustice. Our responsibility as human beings is to speak out to the reality of inhumanity and to speak out against the moral hollowness of political inaction. The only crime, in my view, equal to willful inhumanity is the crime of indifference, silence, and forgetting. Thank you. Thank you.